You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Okay, as I was explaining to you all last week, the council en masse jumped on airplanes and went away. They went to Guam and they went to Saipan. What the purpose of that was because it was the 174th meeting of the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, which, as you know, covers a huge, big part of geography in that part of the Pacific. And it's sort of interesting because when we're talking about it with them all being gone, it's not that they were away from the main Hawaiian islands, but they were able to have people that usually have to travel thousands of miles to come to these meetings. Instead, we went to them. It's like bringing the mountain to the state. So anyway, Josh DeMello, a fisheries analyst and my sidekick on this program quite often, joins us today. And that was quite an interesting trip. And you say pretty much the whole council, pretty much everybody was there.
Yeah, so we do this meeting out in one of the other island areas at least once a year.
Right.
That way these folks don't have to spend the money to fly over and testify on something that they're interested in.
I'm also going to assume that they're pretty impressed with the amount of expenditure and energy and attention they get when the whole council goes there.
It's interesting because you have a lot of fishermen that just show up. It's like here, you know, I guess we take it for granted in Hawaii that the meetings are here twice a year and you come once in a while. There, they know it's only every other year, they come out to these meetings.
And I would imagine that they bring not necessarily a fresh set of eyes. One of the things that we've talked about before, maybe you can explain it. Folks, the reason why the council has been sponsoring a nice part of our Go Fish program all these years, because they were pretty much misunderstood. I mean, years ago when we started this, most people thought the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council was a longline fishing company, you know, and that's just kind of, but it certainly does encompass that fishery. But just so that people know, in the nation, there are how many councils?
There are 8 councils across country.
And we are, by just virtue of the members of it, we cover the most ocean or the most water.
Right. So we have the largest part of the US EEZ.
Yeah. Interesting, though, not the biggest catch.
No, far from it.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, really?
Right. But we do have one of the top value of fish with our longline fishery. So we're usually top 5, top 10 in value of fish landed, even though we're probably like 12th or 15th in landings.
But what does happen, which is interesting to me, is that there's a lot of shared knowledge in what happens there, primarily because of the fact that we've got all these different push and pulls, and yet we take the best care of our fish. So that when you go down to places like Saipan and Guam and these other places, isn't it true that there are quite often lessons to be learned? The folks on there, they want to know what makes Hawaii or this part of the council, what makes our fish maybe better than other areas?
And so the Marianas and even American Samoa, they look to Hawaii as the place where they'd like to be with their fishery. We have the longline fishery. We have the fish auction. We get good prices for our fish. But then you go to places like Guam and Saipan where they may be catching tunas and bottom fish, but they're not getting the same kind of value.
And
part of it is due to not taking care of the fish the way that the fish auction here expects it to be taken care of.
What I liked about it too, though, is that people here, we were in on the main islands, we're spoiled because we have this great effort catching us the fish that we want when we want it and in the right shape. You don't have to question it. Isn't it true that most people can, if they have a problem with a fish that's bought through the normal situation in Hawaii, they can pretty much go back. They can go back in time and get it figured out. You know, as for where'd that fish come and who did the wrong thing to it?
Yeah, and so here we usually take out a lot of ice when we go fishing because we know if we catch fish, you got to keep it on ice. There, some of these areas, you're lucky if you can get ice.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'm glad you brought that up because I've often said, and we hear it all the time in my gang, is the a successful trip is when you've come back from fishing and you throw away ice. In other words, you didn't run out of ice. You had enough.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But you'd be hard-pressed to say, well, okay, ice, where's the ice coming from? You know, these guys, they don't have ice plants all over the place like we do, or opportunity to get it.
Right. So they don't have the 7-Eleven where you can go over there and pick up a bag of ice. So part of what the council is doing is helping to provide fishery development projects, and which may include an ice machine for a community that is dependent on fishing, but they don't have an ice machine, or ice is way too expensive for them to just use it as subsistence fishing.
Okay, and I want to cover, we're going to cover specifically a lot of the things that happened in this meeting, but I also want to let you know that a lot of times when we have discussions about this, it's interesting to me that when some of these places are compensated by the Hawaii Longline guys for quota, that what happens is the money doesn't go into developing a longline boat for them necessarily. What it might go into is putting in a boat ramp and an ice house where they're doing inshore, or I mean, you know, just offshore fishing, not longlining.
Yeah. So in Guam, one of the projects that they worked on with this longline agreement, quota sharing agreement, is they went and built a fishing platform for the elderly and handicapped to get to the water. Previously, you had to climb over the boulders, like down at Kaka'ako, you had to climb down the boulders just to reach the water. But now there's a platform that sticks out over the water, so the folks can actually cast from there. Yeah. And it's important.
What a concept, right?
Right. Yeah. It's important because the fish like a tulai, which is a kule, big eye scad, it runs in that area. So it's a important traditional fish for these folks to be able to gather, especially the elderly.
What is interesting to me is, and we've somehow separated ourselves from that particular shopper, unless you go down to like Chinatown or you go to some of the markets that specialize in stuff that will fit in a frying pan. You know, a lot of those fish that you're talking about, the reason why they're in such high demand is they're simple to cook or not cook. I mean, they're easy to deal with, and they're relatively easy to catch.
And in these island areas, they do like smaller fish. The bigger fish are just hard to bring home. I guess traditionally you'd have to carry it home, and then you'd have to clean it and cut it up. And some of these areas, you actually gave away pieces of the fish based on how big it is.
That being said, and I know that there's time for laughing and it's time for that. A lot of these meetings it's pretty heavy, serious stuff that you deal with. For those that don't know, and we always talk about this, friends, if you listen to the program before, you'll often hear me talk with various players from the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council as a bottoms-up organization. And this really proves it. When you go to Guam and Saipan and these places, it really shows that the people at the end of the food chain are part of the process. So it's not. I guess it's not all serious. It's some fun, but basically, you go down there with the list of things you're trying to accomplish. What were some of those for this year?
So one of the big things for these meetings is that we try to look at setting annual catch limits for a bunch of different species.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about bottom fish, the deep seven bottom fish, and how we set that quota. But I don't think it's too widely known that there are quotas for some of our other species, including the non-deep seven bottom fish, which is mainly uku.
I was going to say, this. Many people feel that the uku should be part of that deep seven, only because of its value. It's actually not caught in deep water. You can go out on the banks and you can go in, you know, 40 fathoms of water and catch uku. And it's a great fish, but yet it needs to be checked at. Has it ever been considered threatened?
I think they are working on a stock assessment to see what the status is of uku, mainly because uku is a snapper, but it really likes to pretend that it's like a tuna and more pelagic.
I got to tell you something funny. Anecdotally, I hear about this a lot of times. I fish sometimes at Penguin Banks, and some of the guys I fish with that have gotten numbers before from a place that was good, it's amazing to me that you can go right out there to your spot, and you can throw in a damashi and pick up a little moana and put it on a hook and send it by, and uku right there. And most of these guys are really respectful of how much they catch. They're going to have it for their own sashimi. They're not necessarily going to sell it. They go get their four or five pieces and they're happy. But some places, maybe you can explain, if you find a pile of fish, it's a pile of opportunity. It's a pile of money. So all you got to do is grab them and then try and sell them. But if you don't have ice and you don't have transport, what happens to that fish?
Right. So I think it all comes down to personal ethics. If when what you're doing when you go out fishing, if you're out there to get fish to sell and to make money to support your family or whatever you use your money for, then you should probably be prepared to catch fish and have enough ice and know where you can sell it for some of these other folks. Who-
okay, I led you astray though when you were talking about it. You were talking about Uku as being separated from the Deep Seven,
right? So there's going to be a stock assessment for Uku, but based on what we know right now, we had to set an annual catch limit for the 2019 to 2021 fishing years. And so at the Scientific and Statistical Committee meeting in Hilo a couple of weeks back, they set an annual an allowable biological catch, which is basically how much that the stock could probably be afforded to
and
take,
still sustain,
and, sustaining itself. And so the annual catch limit can be set there or below. And so what the council did was they set an annual catch limit of and for every year of 127,205 pounds.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
It's a lot. And for what we know about the fishery, it's still below what the commercial fishery is taking.
Okay. Now, by the way, if you want to see more of that, it just so happens that my column in this month's Hawaii Boats and Yachts is about that meeting and about these numbers, particularly about some of the ACLs and things that that we talk about. So feel free to get that either online or in one of your favorite tackle stores and look at the buck stops here and see the fruits of the labor that were going on in these meetings, and which I tried to get to you before they actually got back, and it turns out to be the same time. So that being said, what other species were being looked at outside of the Deep Seven and then the Uku?
So we also looked at the bottom fish in each of the territories. Mm-hmm. So there's annual catch limits that were set on each of those for Guam, American Samoa, and CNMI. But another one that was interesting is Kona crab.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've talked about Kona crab in the past, and we've talked about the different the work that we've been doing to try and get these numbers a little bit better refined. And so this year, or this coming year, 2019, we're actually got an annual catch limit of 3,500 pounds. But that's based on the old assessment that we've had. The new assessment won't be available till around March or so. It was just reviewed this past September. So to get the final stock assessment out, which would look at what the population status is, that final probably come out about March. And so next year, we're going to actually make new annual catch limits for 2020 to 2022.
Yeah, and you know what? There's some people that are nervous about that, right? I mean, there's some people in the community that maybe don't get it, and they're looking at you trying to penalize them for that fishery. But it's never really been a huge market part of us. You know, Kona crab is like more of a personal thing that, you know, it's limited. In other words, oh, you got a nice mango tree. You give me some mangoes, I'm going to give you some Kona crab. It's not the same, is it?
Right. From what I understand, Kona crab has a short shelf life.
So very short.
You can't just catch them, freeze them, and then eat them whenever you want.
Yeah.
It's really a few days. And the real market is in the live Kona crab, so that you can, they're still, while the flesh is still good.
I don't want to say delicious, but I'll say delicious if you're so lucky to get some. Even though they call it, we call it Kona crab, does it exist in other parts of the fishery in the same way?
It does. Mm-hmm. It's called the spanner crab or frog crab. Australia has a big fishery for it. Mm-hmm. But you don't see it too much outside of Hawaii in our region. They do exist in Guam and other areas, but not as much as it's not fish as much as what it is here.
When you're taking a look at that, quite often, and people have asked me, maybe they just don't quite get it, between you and when Malloy Saboteur is here, when we talk about effort, isn't some of the streamlining of these assessments based on this thing called effort, which is sometimes misleading, but you know, sometimes you have a lot more hours of effort, you think, when you shouldn't be counting the travel time, you know what I mean? Isn't that something that people are having a difficult thing to understand?
I think we just don't know a lot about this fishery, and we've been trying to find out more about survivability of the crabs. If a leg breaks, we were told before, if a leg breaks, they die.
That's it. Yeah.
But a project that we did that I think you talked about on an earlier show is that maybe they don't die after all. Maybe
we did see actual evidence, and what they did was by taking these animals and putting them in a controlled environment to see that they regenerated.
Right.
That, you know, or they dealt without it. It's like if you've ever seen a three-legged dog, if the dog was very young when it lost that leg, it doesn't know any. It doesn't think it's a three-legged dog.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't think it's weird. Isn't that the same thing? Maybe.
Part of that, but there's also things like how many crabs do you actually pull up per trap, and is it are all of them eaten by sharks or are only some of them? And there's all these questions, so that there's a lot of research still being done, but just looking at the data and figuring out that, hey, maybe it didn't go down because there's no crabs, but maybe it went down because Mr. X is out of the fishery, and that's why it dropped from 10,000 pounds to 5,000 pounds,
because
he used to catch at least 5,000 pounds every year. Maybe he died, maybe he sold his boat.
Yeah.
So it's just all that investigation into what the data means more than just the numbers.
That's why, my friends, it's so interesting to me when you talk about what happens at the council. And many times, and when you want to go to WPCouncil.org every now and again and look when they're recruiting for people, to me it's always amazing. The people in the field bring back their info, and then it goes into this big machine at the council where it gets categorized and classified and documented and presented. It really is accomplishing a lot more than it used to, and maybe taking even a bow for that at the level of science that's now gone into these assessments, and even stock-taking efforts, you know, to determine this thing is way better than it used to be a couple decades ago.
Yes, and so there's a lot of other things that went on at the council meeting that really deals with all this different science that's going on. So then one of these other things is that we're looking at refining essential fish habitat for precious corals, and that's just from all the different science that's gone on in our region. And so the council took initial action to preliminarily prefer an option to revise the existing EFH based on this new information.
Yeah, and by the way, that is some things that a lot of people don't understand. If you are a coral diver, and I must tell you, decades ago in my life, I was a black coral diver. You had no idea that there was any use for the black coral besides making jewelry. I mean, nobody really knew that were depleting that wonderful resource, what that was there for. You know what I mean? It's really, when you're diving deep and for black coral and you come upon a big tree and it's out in the middle of nowhere hanging onto a leaf, and what it's doing is it's just got all these little branches that are out there. And as the ocean comes by, stuff sticks on it. And then fish come and eat the stuff that's sticking on it. So it actually had a big role. It wasn't just for making jewelry or making necklaces or whatever.
And I think that's what we'd like to get into more of what the ecosystem function of all these species are, because
kind of hard to tell sometimes.
It's definitely hard, and just trying to map out the food webs of what eats what and what is important in each of those diets. That's part of the ecosystem based fishery management that we strive to get to.
I think also, and maybe time has done this and equipment has done this, is that we're starting going further and further out to sea. I mean, before, most of the knowledge was inshore, right? What was maybe just to the reef or maybe just outside the reef. And now look at the swath that the council is dealing with, literally hundreds of miles from land in many cases.
Yeah, and a lot of it is, a lot of our fisheries, pelagic fisheries especially, are predicated on all these protected species interactions. And so the council really deals with a lot with protected species, with ESA, MMPA, all these different...
All the alphabet,
right?
Yeah, yeah. But I still think, though, like you said, what happens on these neighbor island—I mean, not neighbor island, but far-reaching island members of the council, when you're doing the Guam and the Saipan thing. Oh, you do need to explain why it was in both places, why Guam and Saipan.
So before, we used to go out just to one area, but then we'd end up every 3 years in Guam or in Saipan. And so what we did pretty recently, we ended up splitting the meeting between the two island areas. Mm-hmm. And so the first part of this meeting, we went to Saipan and CNMI and held 2 days of meeting.
Yeah.
And then after that, we went to Guam and held the other 2 days of the meeting.
Okay.
So we basically gave both islands an opportunity to see what we're doing.
But I'm guessing it wasn't exactly duplicate of each one, because each area has different areas of concern.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. So we talked about the CNMI issues in CNMI, mm-hmm. and then we also talked about pelagic fisheries and protected species, and I think American Samoa as well.
Yeah. Are there economic opportunities being discovered as a result of these meetings where some of these outlying islands can better themselves, can better their income, can figure a way to, you know, be harvest the bounty of the sea without depleting the bounty of the sea?
I think in Saipan, you have or the CNMI, you have a governor that's really supportive of fishery development,
mm-hmm.
and he's looking at these longline quota agreements, the sharing agreements, to go out and develop his fisheries and see what can catch. A lot of it, to me anyway, is that they don't have the markets to be able to fish really
hard. They don't have a customer base.
They have the fish, and they have the resource, but where are you gonna sell it? And so they've tried to sell it here in Hawaii, sending it to the auction. They've tried to send it to Asia, but in the end, what is the money that you get from that? You take out all the shipping and all these other costs.
It
break even, maybe.
I was going to say, it's nerve wracking, because you either make money or you lose money. And when you lose money and you're in a remote place, there's nowhere to turn to get the money from somewhere else.
Right. So it's developing those shipping channels, those markets, mm-hmm. and maybe selling to the military bases that are there.
Yeah. So anyway, and those, I guess some of these people really don't have that ability to search and try and understand what is available outside their little kuleana of where they are. You know, in other words, if you could get a plane to come in every Friday, for sure, that'd give a fisherman a chance. Okay, I can fly this crab or this fish over there, and it's still going to be fresh when it gets there. So it'll be worth the price of shipping.
Yeah, it's that and being consistent. The commercial fishery. Yeah. You don't function unless you can be consistent and provide that consistent supply.
I love that. You got to explain that. Because here in Hawaii, every commercial fisherman knows when it's time to go, whether the weather is good, bad, it doesn't matter. You need to go fishing. From what we understand there's a lot of people that are sort of still, you know, kind of family attitude. I don't feel like going this month. I'm not going to fish. I'm just going to go. I'll go pick apples.
Well, when you have, say, a contract with Hilton Hotels to provide fish, they expect you to have that fish every day because it's on their menu. They need to provide their menu weeks, probably months in advance.
Yeah.
So they need to make sure that they have it.
Yeah.
And if you're not going out fishing and you're not bringing in that fish, they have to replace that fish with something else.
Exactly. Actually, Josh hit really on the nail on the head here. Because let's say that you've got a restaurant in Waikiki that wants to sell island fresh mai mai every day, and he doesn't get it. And after a while, he just starts to bring in frozen mai mai from, say, Taiwan or someplace, or Thailand or wherever. And he doesn't say fresh mai mai anymore. He just says mai mai. And that would upset the local fisherman because he's using the mai mai name. But it's also the restaurant has the ability to tell the fisherman, hey, we wanted it. You just let us down, and our customers want to eat. So they're in a rock and a hard place sometimes.
Well, especially the hotels in Waikiki in all of our islands, really, is people come to eat our fish.
And it's because of the fishery is so good and the fish is so good, the price is pretty high because you're going to get a great plate, but you're going to pay for it.
Right. And that's why some places have the special a day or catch of the day, and then that's whatever they get in. But you want to be able to showcase something every day. And if it can't be what's caught locally, they're going to go to the imports.
Well, it also may be true of the way that we think here in Hawaii, in very populated areas, we have a different attitude about money and status and stature and what kind of car you're driving and how many swimming pools you have. In some of these areas that you're dealing, these things aren't even on the radar, are they? It's just that, what do I do to feed my family?
Exactly. And so you have these guys who are going out and fishing when they can, but they don't make enough, so then they have to go and work their other jobs. Yeah. So there's not too many real commercial, I say real in quotes, because it's not a full-time, I only do commercial fishing, because they can't really do that without living on the street or on their boats.
Yeah, and that's and we see that. We've seen other examples of that. But I still think, though, that there must be a reason why these mediums are so successful in getting new concepts across to these folks. It's not necessarily come, learn how to make more money. It's just that learn how to make a steady money so that you know that consistently you're going to meet your financial needs all year.
Well, and I think for the council, it's not just the commercial side.
Exactly.
And I think it's not just about money. Mm-hmm. It's about coming to the council and to talk about your lifestyle, your culture, mm-hmm. your tradition, especially mm-hmm. in these other islands that have a bit of a stronger tie because they haven't been as assimilated into American culture.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that we all also talk about is that every now and again, these people are going to come up and say, I'm glad you're meeting here, because we're worried that there's people from outside our area taking our fish. And we've seen that inshore in the main Hawaiian Islands. There's a lot of community-based management being looked at. We talk about that all the time. Is it similar out there?
It is very similar in places like Guam, where you're getting the same immigrant populations that are coming through.
And growing,
Right. And but one of their problems in Guam is that they don't have the regulatory system set up like we do in Hawaii, where we're almost over-regulated in some aspects. Those places want to control it, but they don't have those systems in place. So the council has been working with some of the folks there to see what they can do to improve that by either putting in more regulations or doing something like a code of conduct.
Yeah, and that, by the way, if you want to see, listen, that's a great segue. If you want to see a code of conduct and what that is, go to the website, wpcouncil.org, and see some of the things. And you're going to see some in multi-languages. You're going to see things that are presented throughout the district. And one of them is the commitment and the code, the fisherman's code. And I know that was no easy thing to develop. But once it got developed, people can see the wisdom. Okay, this makes sense. Let's participate. Let's be part of this, especially the young people.
And it's important for some communities who don't want to be regulated, but they want to see change. And it works sometimes. It may lead to other recommendations for management as well.
What was your takeaway on some of the other reasons that the meeting took place? What are some of the accomplishments you felt good about?
I think the annual catch limits was one. I mean, we have to specify them every few years, so it was good to get that out of the way, I guess, for us. There are also some things to do with turtles and longliners, and we've talked about that, and we'll keep talking about that until a biological opinion is published.
I'm glad you brought that up about turtles. We talked about that many, many times, and it seems to me that the effort of replenishment has worked, and that sometimes they're saying maybe all right, an interaction with a turtle is the death of a turtle is important. But what if you hook one and let it go? Why is that even a problem? I know a lot of boats, a lot of guys say that. You know, hey, you know, we have barbless hooks. We do this, we do that. We release these things. They don't die.
Right. And so coming up with those ideas and getting those ideas from the fishermen is extremely important. And one of the things is we appointed a new advisory panel to the 2019-2022 term. And so it's more opportunities for the council to hear about all these ideas that we haven't even thought about yet.
Yeah, I think that's important. I want to make sure that when we cover this as hopefully, and we're going to be doing some more of this, because some of the results of what happens at these meetings they don't become apparent for several months afterwards when people start adapting some of the things that get presented.
And a lot of the outcomes is that we write letters to these different agencies, to the different governments, and ask them to help out the fishermen. And we don't really get to see the results of that for a few months until they respond to our letters.
But what about the increasingly better science that's going into the assessments and things, so that when you do go to these people with concerns of the fishermen, that there's something that they can see, okay, this is what science says is there, this is the decision we have to make, let's do the right thing by these people.
And I think that was a good example at our last council meeting in Maui, in the 173rd meeting, where the fishermen's input into the bottom fish fishery was exemplified, and they got a higher.
But by the way, it kind of shocked them because they were expecting to get their hands tied, and they actually got loosed. You know, they actually increased the quota based on the science and the input.
Right, and actually they sort of felt kind of weird that they were asked, they were going to get more quota when they thought, oh, maybe everybody will still be mad at us. But really, that's just good science.
Do you think that some of these restrictions are going to be put on, as we see more and more stress on the pelagics outside of the tuna? For instance, we've already been talking about it. I know it came up at the meeting. What was the result of the feelings of the meeting when reminded about the Hawaii, the main Hawaiian islands, not being able to sell billfish in the same fashion that we used to?
Yeah, so that was a point of discussion at the meeting, and really these amendments to the Billfish Conservation Act of 2012 were discussed in terms of what questions do fishermen still have about being able to sell billfish products to the mainland. And so the council directed the staff to develop a list of questions and issues associated with the compliance of these amendments, and to send it to the National Marine Fisheries Service to address. Because there are guys who make the marlin jerky or marlin dip or something. Can we even take it with us on the plane? Or maybe we can't. Can we sell it? You know, can we sell marlin jerky in to Costco's in the mainland to distribute? Right. So there's a lot of things that I think are still ambiguous, and we'd like cleared up.
I think the main thing is that, and I get it. You know, we get it on this program, particularly from the catch and release specialist. We learn from the guys that, you know, say, yeah, if you hook up with a really big marlin, you should take it. If you hook up a little one, you should let it go. And I do know that more and more charter boats are letting them go because they want to be able to go catch them again for their charter people. But there's still a lot of people that all of a sudden now that the big mercury scare is, you know, been dealt with, that they want to eat marlin because marlin's a good source of protein. It's dense, thick, good tasting meat, period.
It's not fishy, and you can put sauces on it. But there's a lot of things that I think are going to happen in the next few years related to pelagic fisheries, and it's not necessarily a reflection of the status of the stock, but more of a global conservation effort just to stop fishing, basically.
I've never thought to ask this question. When you go to some of these meetings, I know that every now and then comes the fact that the planet's population is growing, maybe outstripping it the ability to feed itself. And that all of a sudden, if we don't really look at a lot of conservation things, we're going to have to say, well, we used to eat this stuff called fish, but now we don't. Because it doesn't seem to me that the growth of fish is keeping pace with the growth of people. You know, isn't that a major, major concern, particularly where you were in Saipan and Guam, where they don't care about how many people are in Chicago. They just know that they want their fish out of their sea, and they don't want somebody catching it and taking it away to sell it to somebody else.
And I think that's the bigger problem, is that you have these island groups that are so isolated from the rest of the world that if the ships don't come in, you don't have food.
That's right.
But you got
spam jam for you,
Guam and Saipan, not too bad. They grow a lot of vegetables and fruits and stuff. But you got some of the islands in Micronesia where they don't have fresh vegetables because they just don't have the land to farm. Places like American Samoa, where you're not going to get a lot of the different vegetables. You have some traditional vegetables and some foreign vegetables, but you don't have the same kind of land to that has the large agriculture.
As a matter of fact, isn't it sometimes amazing how people can survive in some of those places where it's arid, where there's not enough rainfall, where there's not enough, you know, there's not enough people to sustain it. There's not, you know, there's pesticide use. There's all kinds of things that's ruined the land. They just can't feed themselves.
Well, and then that's why you have a lot of the island people have problems with their health because they're forced to eat canned food. They're eating processed sugars and sodas and all this stuff when the traditional diet of fish and seafood that comes straight from the ocean.
Well, they say, well, we used to do that, but now we sell the fish so we can get the spam.
You know? Right, right. Yeah. And I think that's the bigger problem is that there's not enough people fishing because fishing is hard work, and then you have a lot of dependence on outside sources of protein.
Do you think that we've left anything out? I mean, I know that for a lot of our listeners, they don't understand the majority of the stuff that you have to go through, the scientific data and the meetings. But I do know that there's always a couple of, you know, pretty good takeaway stories and some good things that happened where people were pleasantly surprised that, wow, we sure got a lot done in a short period of time.
I think if you go to www.wpcouncil.org, yep, and you'll see the summary of our actions from our council meeting.
Yeah, and they're great, by the way.
As well as our press releases, yeah, on the meeting, yeah, and they probably explain it better than I could any day.
All right, my friend. Well, thanks for, you know, and oh, by the way, I was mentioning to Josh before we started recording, a lot of our folks that were there at this thing, it was the first super typhoon you guys have been through, right?
Yeah, and that's probably a longer story.
I would say, but I mean, I think that, you know, we've seen storm damage, and I remember being on the air for 2 or 3 days during both hurricanes Eva and then later on Iniki, but we have short memories. And you guys were, a lot of you guys were just young when those things happened. And now you look down there, you said you didn't have a staked interest in the place, but you could sure say, wow, this is a fragile thing that we got here.
Well, for those islands that are used to typhoons coming, yeah, through every year, yeah, it was some huge devastation, huge destruction on islands that are built to withstand, yeah, those kind of, yeah, storms.
Spooky. Oh, yeah. Well, maybe we'll do that. We'll do another one after that one. In the meantime, if you want to hear something on the program, you can go to wpcouncil.org, or you can send me an email to themikebuckshow@gmail.com. So thanks for listening to the program. We'll see you again next time. Catch a lot of fish and save some for us. Have a good one. We'll see you next time. Aloha.